Bernard Boursicault was terrified. The French intelligence agents interrogating him seemed to know everything. It was an awful feeling to be grabbed off the street, shoved into an unmarked car, and locked up in a dank, distant basement. As the agents questioned him, Bernard held out for a while, playing dumb, denying knowledge of the 500-plus documents that had gone missing from the French embassy under his watch. But of course, he had done it. For love, perhaps, but he'd still done it. Bernard shuddered as the French agents began to read through the list of documents he had stolen. Each one was familiar, something he had offered to his Chinese contacts. Some had been rejected, others welcomed. He doubted if that made a difference to his defense. Soon, though, he realized that no defense was going to save him. The agents made it clear that it was the Chinese who'd given him up, the same people he'd been spying for in the first place. But it wasn't the betrayal by the Chinese that really hurt. What destroyed Bernard Boursicault, what nearly killed him, was another traitor closer to home. The woman he loved. The reason he had spied in the first place. Shi Pei Pu. This is Espionage, the Parcast original exploring the missions of the world's most incredible spies and what brought their covert operations into the public eye. Well, throughout this show, we'll explore real-world spy tactics required to impersonate, exploit, and infiltrate the most confidential places in the world. I'm Carter Roy. You can find all episodes of Espionage and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. To stream Espionage for free on Spotify, just open the app and type Espionage in the search bar. At Parcast, we are grateful for you, our listeners. You allow us to do what we love. Let us know how we're doing. Reach out on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. And if you enjoyed today's episode, the best way to help is to leave a 5-star review wherever you are listening. It really does help. This is our second episode on Bernard Boursicault, a French diplomat who fell in love with Chinese opera singer Shi Pei Pu. Well, Pei Pu claimed to Bernard that she was a woman who disguised herself as a man, and in the 1960s, their relationship resulted in a son, Bertrand. Well, last week, Bernard turned to espionage out of fear for Pei Pu's safety. Stealing documents from the French embassies in Beijing and Mongolia, and passing them along to Chinese government contacts. This week, Bernard and Pei Pu attempt to escape from oppressive China and forge a new life in France. But as the authorities close in around them, Bernard learns a shocking secret. By 1980, Bernard Boursicault had become accustomed to a double life. As a diplomat in the French embassy in Beijing, he had secreted important documents out of the building and given them to Chinese authorities. While abroad, he was in love and had borne a son with Chinese citizen Shi Pei Pu. But at the same time, whenever he returned to France, he was living with a man, Thierry Toulet, and the couple was building a life together in Paris. This double life was aided by Bernard's work, which took him to far-flung places around the world, from Saudi Arabia to Jerusalem to Belize to Scotland. He always made an effort to return to Beijing, either on a tourist visa or official work transfer, to see Pei Pu and their son, Bertrand. Even when his relationship with Pei Pu started to grow distant, sex was infrequent and passionless, with Pei Pu shutting off the lights and taking charge while Bernard lay disinterested on the bed. But after the 1976 death of Chinese Chairman Mao Zedong, the couple saw a chance to realize a long-time dream, to get Peipu and Bertrand to France, where they could live with Bernard as a family, safe from the oppressive Chinese government. Getting out wouldn't be easy, though. Bernard's first attempt was through an old friend who worked for the French National Center for Scientific Research, a government organization. Using his position, the friend issued an invitation to Peipu to visit Paris on the basis of her clout as an opera singer. But this was insufficient for the Chinese government. If they were going to allow Peipu to travel outside the country, they said, the invitation would have to be from a cultural organization. An informal invite, even from a government official, wouldn't pass muster. And there was another problem, too. In April 1982, Peipu suffered a heart attack. It put her in the hospital for 3 months and left her frail in the aftermath. When she finally returned home, though, she found good news awaiting her. Back in France, Bernard's friend had been reaching out to various government officials working in cultural offices. And finally, he managed to obtain a real official invitation. The French Foundation for Human Sciences asked Xi Peipu to visit the country for 3 months to tour and lecture on Chinese opera. Recognizing the opportunity to promote their own culture, the Chinese government approved the necessary visas. In October 1982, both Xi Peipu and Bertrand, who was now a young teenager, boarded a plane bound for France. Bernard, however, was stuck in Belize on a foreign service assignment, hoping to get home soon, so when the plane landed, it was Bernard's boyfriend, Thierry, waiting for them at the airport. Peipu was still weak, unable to walk long distances without frequent breaks to catch her breath, so whatever her feelings about this greeting, she was in no position to push him away. Thierry took her to his and Bernard's shared apartment. Thus began 3 awkward weeks, as Bernard tried to convince the French embassy to grant his return to Paris, and Peipu and Thierry, essentially strangers, learned to cohabitate. An introverted man, Thierry was sometimes frustrated by Peipu's neediness, asking to be shown around Paris, worrying over the appliances in the apartment, and generally needing her hand held. He was also confused by the fact that, even at home, Peipu never let on that she was a woman. She stayed in her disguise at all times, wearing baggy men's trousers and shirts. Although she didn't know it, of course, she was following classic rules for disguise in espionage. The former CIA chief of disguise, Jonah Mendez, advises that it takes more than just a hat or a scarf to hide one's identity. Sometimes, the most recognizable thing about a person is the way they carry their own body, the way they walk and move. By wearing baggy clothes, Peipu could hide her true female shape and deceive any onlookers. But living with someone who had to constantly hide her true identity wore on Thierry in unexpected ways. It became clear that Bernard had never fully considered the logistics of Thierry and Peipu living together. When friends asked Thierry who Peipu and Bertrand were, he realized they'd never concocted a cover story. He thought on his feet and introduced them vaguely as friends from Beijing. Despite these hiccups, as the weeks passed waiting for Bernard's return, the trio settled into a routine. Well, that routine was thrown into chaos by Bernard's homecoming 3 weeks later. Thierry, Peipu, and Bertrand waited for him at the airport gate. Bernard stepped out and joyously received his son. Then he exchanged a kiss with Peipu, and like something from a black comedy, realized that he had made a terrible mistake. In his mind, Bernard had pictured this as a beautiful moment, their grand reunion after 2 decades of keeping their romance a secret. Even in the face of their recent distance, he had believed this would be a reunion to remember. but he was disappointed. Pei Pu was weak from the heart attack, and she was older, no longer the young woman he fell in love with. Even more, Bernard felt the weight of commitment bearing down on him. He and Pei Pu were together now, bound forever in ways he couldn't yet foresee. On the trip back to the apartment, Bernard ricocheted between the old feelings of love for Pei Pu and his newfound discontent with her. This was the woman he had risked his career over, stolen documents to protect. That meant something. And they had a son together. That meant even more. Well, this internal drama was wearing Bernard out, on top of the fact that he hadn't been able to sleep on the plane. He crashed into his own bed as soon as he got home, down the hall from Pei Pu's room. But at dawn, Pei Pu came knocking. Bernard let her in, and Pei Pu wasted no time launching into her concerns. She demanded to know why Bernard had slept in a separate room that night. She sensed his distance. It was intolerable. She was miserable and wanted to return to China. Bernard managed to talk her down for the moment, but these outbursts became the dominant theme of their life together in Paris. Pei Pu was seeing things she had never thought she would see, all the sights of Paris that she had dreamed of with Bernard, but she was resolutely dissatisfied and convinced of Bernard's new disdain for her. However, for all her complaining, Pei Pu was thriving in Paris. She was a figure of interest, a foreign opera star from a famously repressive country. If the locals, even those at the cultural institute that invited her, hadn't exactly heard of her, well, that could be explained easily enough by China's cultural isolation. They did know Mei Longfang, her mentor, and that was a mighty impressive name in the opera community. Bernard was growing increasingly frustrated, however. All of his money was going toward caring for Pei Pu, paying for their apartment, her expenses, little Bertrand's needs. He was broke. Meanwhile, Pei Pu was collecting income from her speeches and her TV appearances and spending very little of it. The situation seemed bound to collapse in on itself, and in the summer of 1983, it finally did. But not at all in the way Bernard expected. Bernard and Thierry left the apartment late the morning of June 30th. They had separate plans, but agreed to reconvene for lunch in a few hours. Bernard headed down a busy Parisian shopping street, his mind in the clouds. When it happened, he didn't see it coming. A man tackled him. There, in the street, in broad daylight. Thinking he was being mugged, Bernard fought back and eventually managed to throw his wallet down onto the sidewalk. He hoped that it would appease his attacker. He was wrong. Soon, more men appeared, all around him, dragging him toward a car. Bernard struggled, yelled, and clutched with all his might to a nearby tree. As he hung onto the tree, men pulling him by his legs and body, he began to gather the attention of onlookers. One of them cried out, demanding an explanation from the attackers. That's when one of them pulled out a badge. They were police, they explained. And they had some questions for Bernard Boursicot. Next, Bernard faces the consequences of his spying and the truth about Shi Pei Pu. Now, back to the story. On June 30th, 1983, Bernard Boursicot should have felt triumphant. He had done it. He had gotten Shi Pei Pu and their son Bertrand out of China, to France, and achieved a decades-long dream. But Pei Pu had been miserable, despite finding great success in Paris. Somehow, Bernard had failed her. And as he sat in the interrogation room, facing down a small cluster of French intelligence officers, He felt that he had failed himself, too. They came right out with it, asking Bernard about his work at the embassies in Beijing and Mongolia during the years 1969 to 72 and 77 to 79. These were the exact years he had been sneaking secret government files to his Chinese contacts. Kong and Zhao, and the detectives were blunt. There were some 500 documents missing between the two embassies. Then, the detectives had still more questions about Shi Pei Pu, this strange man Bernard had been pulling strings for. As they spoke, it became clear what had happened. They had tapped Bernard and Pei Pu's phones. Wiretapping has a long history in espionage and law enforcement alike. It has been in use practically as long as phones themselves, with early wiretaps dating back to 1890. Espionage historian H. Keith Melton describes the wide range of eavesdropping devices used by intelligence agencies, from listening systems installed behind hotel room walls to tiny microphones placed covertly right in the receiver of a phone line. Though not confirmed, it's likely that the French intelligence agency physically intercepted a phone line near Bernard's apartment, routed it through their recording devices, then back into the main channel, a common technique at the time. They had long been suspicious of the circumstances that led a Chinese opera star to live with a French diplomat, and the content of the calls they intercepted got them digging into Bernard's past in China. Now, they were accusing Bernard of espionage. They specifically highlighted a non-work trip to China, one that had only been possible thanks to his government contacts. There were only a few people who knew and could have told the French about that trip. Running down the list, Bernard came to an awful conclusion. It had to have been the Chinese themselves who gave him up. No longer useful to the government, he had been sold out, betrayed. The Chinese had given French intelligence everything. The agents read off a list of documents that Bernard had taken, and they were right on the money. The interview didn't last long after that. Bernard figured he was cooked, and the best way out was to be honest. He had a sympathetic story, he thought, and over the course of 2 days, he put together a 15-page letter explaining what he'd done and why. The investigators were delighted that they got a confession so easily, but they were shocked by one major aspect of Bernard's letter, that the famed opera singer Shi Pei Pu, currently touring France, was in fact a woman. Bernard was clear on this point. He was convinced that if the police only knew about the secret romance, about he and Pei Pu's child, about his attempts to protect his family via espionage, they would understand and let him go. It was a classic appeal to pathos. Things didn't quite go the way he expected. Bernard was immediately jailed, and the police paid a visit to his apartment to find Shi Pei Pu. They came in expecting a woman, per Bernard's statement, but the person who lived there appeared to them to be male, or deeply androgynous anyway. With delicate hands and a high-pitched voice, Pei Pu also had an Adam's apple, but according to Bernard, had given birth to a child. They commenced questioning, though Pei Pu told them little. She admitted to being Bernard's mistress, but denied any knowledge of his espionage. But the ploy failed quickly. A week later, Pei Pu was formally charged with espionage against the French government, despite the fact that she denied knowledge of Bernard's schemes. And despite the doctor's warning given her recent heart attack, she too was arrested pending a trial. With Bernard's explosive claims about Pei Pu being a woman in disguise, The case had begun to pick up steam in the press, too. The media started to call her the Chinese Mata Hari, after the famous Dutch spy. As a result, investigators were keen to determine, once and for all, what Pei Pu's true gender was. They just needed to perform a medical examination. Bernard had little sense of this ongoing controversy. In part, this was because he had no doubt that Pei Pu was a woman, but it was also because, in the first week of his prison stay, he was heavily drugged. He voluntarily began seeing a psychiatrist immediately upon entering the prison, and the mixture of anti-anxiety meds and mood elevators left him perpetually confused and drowsy. His confusion only increased on July 8, 1983. He was told that Pei Pu had been arrested too, and placed in the same prison. Bernard couldn't understand. He was in a men's prison. Why would they place her there? He assumed that Pei Pu had refused to be searched, and as a result had been taken for the man she posed as in public life. He didn't have much time to ponder, though. Soon the police arrived to transport him and Pei Pu back to their apartment to conduct a search. As Bernard watched investigators scour the home, Pei Pu at his side, he felt an odd serenity. He was confident that, once it was clear that this was a love story, he would be cleared of the charges. Who wouldn't betray their country to protect their child and lover? He watched as the police dug through relics of his past with Pei Pu, bagging them as evidence. They unearthed an old address book and a pile of love letters. He knew that once the police were finished, he and Pei Pu would be separated again, brought back to their separate wings of the prison. But Bernard had an idea. To show the police that this really was a love story, he suggested to Pei Pu that they marry. She simply said, "It's too late." And it was. On July 13th, 1983, the French police made a surprising announcement. Despite Bernard's claims, Shi Pei Pu was a man. Bernard's dramatic story about a woman in disguise was false. The police had considered all the options. Hermaphroditism, in which Pei Pu might have had both male and female genitals. They considered surgery, in which Pei Pu may have changed their genitals, but their conclusion was that, biologically, Pei Pu was male. In his prison cell, Bernard heard the report on the radio and was floored. He cried out in anguish and in confusion as his amused cellmates looked on. They were less amused that night, as Bernard tossed and turned with nightmares that caused him to scream and shout in his sleep. By the morning, he had internally rejected the police findings. Pei Pu was a woman, he was sure. After all, where else could Bertrand have come from? With both of his parents under arrest, teenage Bertrand had been sent to stay with Bernard's parents in his rural hometown. While Bernard's family was still baffled by what happened. They knew that their son had been arrested, along with that strange male companion he'd been hanging around with lately, but the pieces didn't fit, and Bertrand was perhaps the least fitting piece of all. One weekend, the teen was sent to stay with his Aunt Mimi. She had a daughter about Bertrand's age, and the three of them stayed up playing games and talking. But Bertrand was withdrawn. When Mimi asked what was wrong, Bertrand answered honestly. He said, "I'm not Bernard's son." Bertrand told Mimi about his birthplace, in a distant province of China near the Soviet border. He was old enough, he said, to remember his parents, his real parents, who were part of a minority group in annexed Chinese territory. They were Uyghurs, he said, a Muslim minority. As a child, he had been riding with his father through the desert when they were besieged by Chinese soldiers. His father was thrown from the horse, and Bertrand was knocked out. Though the soldiers apparently returned him to his mother, he never saw his father again. A few years later, starving and unable to provide for him, Bertrand's mother brought her little boy to the capital of the province and handed him off to some strange men. These men had brought him to Shi Pei Pu. Aunt Mimi didn't know what to do. She didn't have enough information, for one. She still didn't understand how Pei Pu fit into all of this, or even how Bernard fit, really. Unsure how to proceed, she decided to keep the story to herself for the time being. Bernard hadn't yet learned about Bertrand's true parentage. He was too busy dealing with, or denying, the revelations about Pei Pu's gender. In pretrial motions before the judge, each defendant was given the chance to present their version of events. Bernard stuck to his story. Pei Pu had claimed to be a woman, and they had raised a child together. He had committed espionage, but he'd only ever handed the Chinese unimportant documents, and everything he'd done was an act of protection for his family. Pei Pu's story, however, was changing. At times, Pei Pu said he had never claimed to be a woman to Bernard. He had perhaps made suggestions, but he said Bernard had seen him naked many times. They had even discussed his penis. According to Pei Pu, Bernard had told him that they could simply have an operation done. Other times, Pei Pu said that he had been raised as a boy, but shortly before meeting Bernard, had begun to question his own identity. He wondered if he might, in fact, be a woman. Pei Pu claimed that Bertrand wasn't his son, but was Bernard's son. After having sex one night, Pei Pu said that he saved a sample of Bernard's semen, and the next day brought it on ice to a doctor who specialized in artificial insemination. Bernard clung to this detail. Bertrand really was his son. But the accumulation of Pei Pu's other deceptions seemed immense and intolerable. He began swapping pronouns when talking about Pei Pu to the judge. Sometimes he him, sometimes she her. Despite maintaining to his psychiatrist that he still thought Pei Pu was a woman. But as the months of testimony continued, the truth became hard to deny, particularly once it came from Pei Pu himself. One day in court, Pei Pu responded in frustration to another question about his gender. He said, "Is it important if I'm a man or a woman?" Later that day, Pei Pu and Bernard returned to the prison where they both resided. Bernard, who had for months been hearing from all corners that Pei Pu was a man, finally asked him point blank. Pei Pu nodded. It was true. Bernard wanted proof, though, and so Pei Pu unzipped his pants and briefly, casually showed him. Then, as if he had simply shown Bernard an interesting newspaper article, Pei Pu moved on, nonchalantly talking about their plans for the future. Their plans for Bertrand. Their plans together. The major question remained, however. How had this Chinese man convinced a relatively sexually experienced Frenchman that he was a woman, despite having male genitals? How had the two been together for nearly 20 years and even lived together without Bernard catching on? Well, some theories suggested that Bernard did know, but was now hiding it, afraid of being outed as gay, or perhaps unwilling to admit his sexuality to himself. Bernard pointed out the preposterousness of this notion. He lived with a man. Thierry still visited him in prison regularly. He was gay, or possibly bisexual, but he wasn't ashamed of it. The truth, Papou revealed to medical examiners, was both simple and nearly unbelievable. He demonstrated to them one day in the midst of an examination. Using his hand, he pushed his testicles up into his body, then he tucked his penis between his legs. The effect, with his scrotum still outside his body, resembled, at a distant glance, a vagina. Well, there was a lot left unanswered by this explanation, though. It was a visual trick. How it worked physically, when he and Bernard were actually making love, was still a mystery. Even Bernard couldn't say, except to concede that their relations had been less pleasurable than those he'd had with other women. Papou, for his part, was reluctant to speak further on the matter, maintaining that he had never deliberately misled Bernard into thinking he was a woman. But there was a second big question lingering over everything. Not just how Papou had done it, but why? However, Bernard was distracted from these questions surrounding Papou's gender by a piece of even more devastating news. One afternoon in the spring of 1984, lawyers came to Bernard with the results of his and Bertrand's blood tests. They were unrelated. But Bernard had always maintained to himself that he had betrayed his country and lied to his co-workers for noble reasons. He did it to protect the woman he loved, and he did it for his son. Now he learned he had never had either. Late one night, Bernard removed the blades from a cheap grocery store shaving razor he'd been provided. With clumsy and desperate strokes, he began to slice away at his own neck. Coming up, the increasingly complicated case winds its way through the legal system. Now, back to the story. Bernard Boursicot and Chi Peipu's lives had come undone. In the summer of 1983, they were both arrested in connection with Bernard's theft of French documents for the Chinese government. Papou had been outed as a man, disguising himself as a woman, disguising herself as a man. Bernard denied the revelations to himself and others for years as their case wound through the French court system, but by spring of 1984, he reached his breaking point. Upon learning that his son was not, in fact, his biological son, Bernard attempted suicide. Bernard was discovered, fortunately, before he succumbed to his injuries, but the psychological damage lingered, as did the questions. Why had Papou lied? Had he been working with the Chinese government? Was this all a terrible grand plot against Bernard? In May 1986, the trial began in earnest. It was brief, but filled with laughter from the tittering spectators, who were incredulous at every new detail of the relationship between Papou and Bernard. In court, Papou denied having any involvement with the Chinese government. The story was as Bernard had told it, except for his gender, and the interventions of Kong and Zhao had come as much as a surprise to him as to Bernard. Bernard's lawyer pointed to the paltry offerings contained within the stolen documents. Jokes from the ambassador to Mongolia about yaks. Requests for office supplies. Press packets compiled from public newspaper clippings. Bernard, it seemed, had never even actually betrayed his country. Well, this argument was not entirely convincing, apparently. Though the judge didn't give the maximum sentence of 20 years imprisonment, he did give both Papou and Bernard 6 years. It wasn't as bad as it could have been, but it was still a blow, particularly to Bernard, who had labored under the delusion that his pure motives might yet save him. Still loyal, Bernard's partner, Thierry, took a job near the prison in order to visit him frequently. So did Bertrand, Bernard's son, now 17 years old. It seemed like this would be their new way of life, at least for the foreseeable future. But in early 1987, Peipu was released after just 11 months behind bars. Well, apparently, at a function in China, the Chinese Minister of Foreign Affairs had pulled aside a high-ranking advisor to French President François Mitterrand. He had expressed the Chinese government's desire to see Peipu released. When the advisor briefed President Mitterrand on the situation, both agreed that Peipu's actions were relatively minor, especially compared to the stakes of keeping the peace with rising power China. After some back and forth with the Chinese government, ensuring Peipu's safety in the event of his release, Mitterrand officially granted him a pardon. Peipu's release gave Bernard grounds to appeal his decision too. His lawyer launched an appeal and, with recommendations from Bernard's government friends, obtained a pardon for Bernard too. He was released in August 1987, a year after the trial and 4 years after his initial arrest. They were free men now, but of course, much had transpired between the two. Bernard was not exactly looking to welcome Peipu back into his life. Instead, he and Thierry lived on Bernard's meager savings, some unemployment income, and other scraps of money. They traveled some, and Bernard even spent time with Bertrand, who was working with Peipu at a French restaurant. Though they lived somewhat anonymous, uninteresting lives after prison, Bernard and Peipu were known public figures. The case had made the two into a national mockery, and their story was only publicized further with the advent of the 1988 play, M. Butterfly. Written by David Henry Huang, the play exaggerated some elements of Bernard and Peipu's story. For example, it turned the Bernard character into a higher-ranking official. But fundamentally, it told the true story of Bernard and Peipu's relationship and spread it to a wide audience, even winning the Tony for Best Play that year. In 1989, Bernard sued the production and earned himself a percentage of royalties in a settlement. Though Peipu's lawyer attempted to get him a settlement deal too, Peipu proved too difficult to work with and the money never materialized. Although one would expect a sharp split following the revelations about Peipu, the truth ended up more complicated and difficult. Bernard and Peipu both acted as parent figures to Bertrand, despite neither of them being his biological parents. And though Bernard felt betrayed by Peipu, he didn't describe much anger toward him. He simply said, "It is better to be cheated than to cheat," and dismissed the whole thing. For many years, the two would still get together and drink on two occasions, the Chinese New Year and the anniversary of Bernard's release from prison. Peipu's own motivations in this affair remain mysterious, illuminated only slightly by an interview he gave after leaving prison. In it, he described his own relationship to Bernard and to gender in general. He said, "To the world, I am a man, but to myself and to Bernard, I was, and I am, a woman. Always a woman." In the 1960s, and in particular in the repressive society of Maoist China, it's possible that Peipu was simply what we might now call gender fluid. If we take his word for it, he struggled to limit himself to a single gender identity. Perhaps he simply found someone he loved, someone who loved him, and did whatever it took to preserve that relationship. In 2009, at the age of 70, Shi Peipu died. He had spent his life avoiding questions about his relationship with Bernard and about his own gender and sexuality. He found them distasteful and rarely granted interviews. Bernard claimed that in the months before his death, Pepu still called occasionally and professed, as ever, his genuine love for the diplomat. But Bernard himself claimed to feel nothing. Pepu and Bernard's sad story is an unusual espionage tale. Bernard's spying didn't alter the course of geopolitical history. In fact, the inconsequential nature of the documents he stole may be the reason he's a free man today. To the extent that he's known, it's less as a dashing 007 figure and more as a buffoon, the man who slept with another man and didn't even realize it. What's most poignant to many of us about the story may be the romance, even, or especially, with its deceptions and betrayals. It created a bizarre family, one of three people unrelated by blood but inextricably bound to one another. These ties were so tight that Bernard eagerly used his position in order to ensure the safety of these people. And even after the truth came out, both Pepu and Bernard still acted as Bertrand's parents. But the romance of the tale may be more closely tied to the espionage than it seems at first glance. Bernard found a thrill in leading a double life, at least early on, in both his relationship with Pepu and his espionage. He met secretly with Pepu at night, at a time when relationships with foreigners were frowned upon, then outright forbidden by the Chinese government. He worked jovially with his colleagues by day, only to betray them and steal their files at night. He did this to protect his family, but by his own admission, he did it for the thrill as well. The dangers of espionage are myriad, of course, but what can ultimately pose the greatest risk is the simple fact of trying to lead two opposing lives. In love, and in spycraft both, it's rarely a game that comes without great cost. Thank you for listening to Espionage. We'll be back Friday with a new episode. You can find more episodes of Espionage and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify. Well, not only does Spotify already have all of your favorite music, but now Spotify is making it easy for you to enjoy all of your favorite Parcast originals, like Espionage, for free from your phone, desktop, or smart speaker. And to stream Espionage on Spotify, just open the app, tap Browse, and type Espionage in the search bar. And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast, and Twitter at Parcast Network. We'll be back next week with another deep dive into the world of clandestine operation. Espionage was created by Max Cutler and is a Parcast Studios original. It is executive produced by Max Cutler. Sound design by Anthony Valsic, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro, Carly Madden, Freddie Beckley, and Paul Mahler. This episode of Espionage was written by Thomas Dolan Gavitt. I'm Carter Roy.